wanted to make spaghetti, and I just needed a can of tomatoes, and I kept asking for pompelmo. I wanted sugo di pompelmo, which is grapefruit sauce, and I'm like, and sugo di pomodoro is tomato sauce. I'm like, I want that sugo di pompelmo. Sugo di. And the guy's like, what the hell? We don't have that. I'm like, what is this problem? I'm fluent. I'm totally fluent in Italian. What is your problem? I want my grapefruit sauce.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I've remixed a literary panel conversation I had with novelist Anthony Doerr a good 5 years before I started this podcast. At the time, I knew him mainly through his 2007 expatriate memoir, Four Seasons in Rome, which I later quoted a few times in my book, The Vagabond's Way. Though now Tony is best known for his 2014 World War II novel, All the Light We Cannot See, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, was turned into a Netflix miniseries, and has gained nearly 230,000 reader reviews on Amazon.com. I shared the stage with Tony at Iowa State University's Symposium on Wildness, Wilderness, and the Creative Imagination back in 2012, an event that put me into conversation with well-known and soon-to-be well-known authors, people like Winter's Bone novelist Daniel Woodrell, poet and World of Wonders author Amy Natsuku Matatl, and the event's host, novelist, screenwriter, and comic book writer Benjamin Percy. The panel discussion with Tony Doerr and myself is moderated by graduate student Lindsay DeAndrea, and together we talk about things like keeping a travel journal, which Tony calls, quote, a place to practice translating the world into sentences. We talk about how one's consciousness as a traveler is enhanced by approaching the experience as a writer. We talk about the ethical duties of portraying other cultures and how research can make narratives so much better and more believable. We talk about how at times the fresh eyes of travel can help you see a place in ways that some local people have stopped noticing, and how experiencing places is affected by the environments you're used to, how seeing the wilderness and all its richness is a challenge if you're used to looking with eyes that have been attuned to cities and vice versa. A lot of what we discuss revolves around how Tony's task as a fiction writer has different challenges than my own as a nonfiction writer. We also share some amusing anecdotes about humiliating book tour experiences. We start after a question about how traveling slowly affects our ability to connect with people and find unique experiences on the road. Let's listen in. Tony and I were talking. He asked me the great question, what do you do when you get sick, or how do you deal with bad food on the road? And my answer was sort of, it depends on what kind of trip I'm on. If I'm on a two-week trip to Southeast Asia and I get malaria, well, then it's going to ruin my trip. But I've had malaria twice in Southeast Asia, and I was just there indefinitely. I didn't have a plan to go home, and I just got over my disease, and it became a part of my experience, and I moved on. It's also, from a narrative standpoint, from a writing standpoint, this is another thing we were talking about at lunch, how often the traveler experiences other countries but within the tourist matrix, which sort of reduces you to the role of a consumer. And I think the longer you travel and the slower you go, the more you can get through that that sort of consumer dynamic of travel. And I think that's the reason why so much great nonfiction and fiction about faraway places comes from returned Peace Corps volunteers, which includes like Bob Chicotis and Paul Theroux and Tony D'Souza and Peter Hessler. It's because they've broken through that veneer of tourism. They've learned local languages and they've understood places at an intuitive level. And so I'm not saying you can't write about a place that you've only been to for a day or a week, because many of the stories in my newest book are about fairly brief encounters. But at that level of encounter, you almost have to acknowledge your role as an outsider and someone who might be seen in that sort of consumer role as guest. So I'm sure it has a different dynamic for a fiction writer.
Yeah, it does and it doesn't. I've kept a journal ever since I was 16. My friends used to make a lot of fun of me for it and call it my man diary. Be like, what are you writing in there? But it was never really a place to just like complain about Susie dumping me in 11th grade or something. It wasn't so much about myself at all as just a place to practice translating the world into sentences. And early on, I learned that when I was in a strange, unfamiliar place, especially if I was a little bit uncomfortable, I was writing a lot more in my journal than if I was at home. really all of my work, my chief interest in life is about habitualization, which is just, you know, taking the same route to work every day. And, you know, those of you who've lived in the same house for a long time and cooked 1,000 meals in there, you know where everything is in every drawer. And I'm interested in seeing those habits, not necessarily shattered, but shaken up a little bit. You know, it's like when you rent a house and you get there in the dark and you've got to cook a meal, it's a much more intense experience. And that's how I feel when I'm in a strange place, especially if people around me aren't speaking English. And so really, for me, beginning to even pretend to know a place for fiction comes from that journal and just writing sentences that you'll never know if they'll be used in anything finished. A great liberating thing in a journal, especially if you're handwriting it, is that you know this isn't something that people will see, and it's a very different kind of writing than, you know, writing for publication. And even if I'm doing a travel piece, which I've only done a few nonfiction travel pieces, you know, I still keep a journal in addition to the notes I'm taking for a magazine. Just because, you know, it's free. You can, your sentences can be crappy, and you can write about the way a tree intersects with the sky for as long as you want. You know, you don't have to worry about it. The readers of the New York Times getting super bored. So for me, beginning to absorb a place starts with going slow and looking at it and trying to translate it into sentences. And, you know, if you're interested in writing, just start doing that in airports. You know, play little games with yourself. You know, you can make up stories about people. You probably already do that in your head, you know. We have so many distractions and increasingly great ones, like Downton Abbey or something, you know, we were just talking about. But it's important to also slow down and just have a notebook that doesn't also have Scrabble on it or something, you know, and write with your hands and ink.
Moving on to this idea of story, both in fiction and nonfiction, when you're traveling and you have these sort of experiences, or when you pick up on some information that you feel might work really well for a story, what is it that sort of tells you that these stories are the ones that you want to start with, that you want to tell? Of all the people that you meet when you're traveling, or of all the characters that pop into your head, what are the ones that sort of connect with the most?
Sometimes it's something you know immediately, and sometimes it might not occur to you until months later when you're sitting down at your desk, you know, which parts of a travel experience resonated with you the most. Yeah, it's tough. And I guess this sort of addresses the whole idea of your consciousness as a traveler versus your consciousness as a writer who's traveling. And are you having experiences to have experiences, or are you having experiences to collect experiences? And if you start taking notes in the middle of experience, is it going to ruin your experience, or is it going to ruin your writing? I mean, it's interesting. I think once you're in a certain writer mindset, you can't ever stop thinking about how am I going to write about this. Mm. And you don't want to sort of prostitute your consciousness constantly towards the act of writing, because you want to have something spontaneous and true going on. But I think also that writer's consciousness can also challenge you to do things and engage people in a way that you wouldn't normally. Again, going back to the consumer level of travel, where you're sort of receiving experiences and comfort and new sights as opposed mm-hmm. to experiencing them. So I'm trying to think of specific examples. Well, like in my latest book, I have a story about this really eccentric guy in Beirut who is so friendly and so overwhelmingly hospitable that I named the story My Beirut Hostage Crisis. He was so nice, I couldn't get away from him. I knew immediately that I was going to write about him. And one of the biggest challenges was just because he was so flamboyant. Actually, if you come, I'll touch on this in my reading. He was so flamboyant, it was a matter of what not to write about him, because Lebanon is a very serious place. that wasn't even a Freudian slip. He was a dude. Lebanon is a serious place, and there's something very comical about this guy named Mr. Ibrahim. But if I just concentrated on the comical aspects of him, just a very eccentric, weird guy, then it would have sold short what the true story was, which is how this guy reacted to living in a place that should be a great, you know, Mediterranean city, but isn't because of war. And so I immediately knew I was going to write about him. Somebody I didn't know I was going to write about until months later was my barber when I lived in Thailand and was writing my first book, who was a Burmese refugee, and over the course of many haircuts, I realized had lived a much more interesting life than a lot of adventure travelers you read about in Outside Magazine. And it was probably 2 years later that I realized I should probably write about him, because he represented something very true about Thailand or the Thai-Burmese border where I was. And it was probably 2 years after that before I figured out how to write about him, because he had become a friend, and I wanted to sort of honor who he was. And so it was hard finding a way in. So I guess there's different ways to approach a given travel experience, and sometimes what you think is the obvious one doesn't make any sense when you sit down to write it. And sometimes you sit down to write it, and suddenly you're writing something that you had no plan on writing about. So I don't know how it is for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's just entirely different. I'm a fiction writer, and I'm not looking at people as material necessarily. When I'm writing fiction, I'm just playing with language, and the way a songwriter is playing with a keyboard until a tune emerges, or a painter is moving paint around until an image emerges. I'm very rarely so schematic that I would cannibalize a real person from an encounter that would seem slightly commercial or capitalist or something. Like, oh, I've met her, now I'll put her in a story. So for me, fiction comes much more out of conflict and interests. Often, maybe to answer your question, how do you know if you're onto something? For me, it's if I have a curiosity that won't let me go, and I just want to learn more about it, whether it's venomous snails or the way seeds are preserved or hibernation. I was talking to Lindsay earlier about that. One of my stories called The Hunter's Wife just came out of an interest I had in hibernation. Like, what the hell are frogs doing with their hearts beating, once a minute in the middle of the winter all around us right now? Are they dreaming? Is that even considered being alive? And then only after, 20 days of playing around with sentences will characters and conflict start to emerge up out of that. So writing fiction about different places is a very different kind of thing, I think.
Going back to sort of the idea of the man in Beirut that you met, and speaking about the true story behind something, and that's really, really the heart of it. For both of you, I was wondering, all writers commonly seek a sense of universality in their writing, and so both of you achieve that very well in your work. How do you kind of balance the local and the global, or the micro with the macro? How can other writers maybe focus on a specific place, on an even foreign place at times, and still achieve that sense of universality?
I think that's an important mission for a travel writer, a nonfiction travel writer, because as a travel writer, you're in a unique position to navigate the space between news media, which is panic-driven. You're not going to read about certain parts of the world unless something blows up there. And then the other pole, which is advertising and sort of tourist images that show us golden or clear blue waters and empty beaches, which don't exist either. And so we're navigating the middle ground, which is making far-flung parts of the world seem human. And so I guess one mission or one thing that I find myself returning to is going to a faraway place and finding what is relatable about it, or finding what is essential and human about it. Even though it might be culturally different, there are certain things that that one can hold in common. And you used Ibrahim, the Lebanon story, as an example. I think using the specific to speak to the universal, my mission in that story ended up being to write about this one eccentric man in such a way that his story said something about the place, that his story was tied into Beirut, and the fact that he couldn't physically talk about parts of the city that had been destroyed by war. He pretended to pretend they didn't exist. He took me around the city, showing me only fancy restaurants and beautiful monuments and stuff. And so much of his Beirut was this he was sort of this Don Quixote figure, sort of this fantastical, the Beirut that could have been. And if you go to Beirut, it's easy to understand that this could be a fantastic city. I mean, the Lebanese people there are so nice, and they're very good business people, but they've lost out to geography. And so it ended up being that the universals of the city were communicated through this strange man I met named Mr. Ibrahim. And that's something I come back to a lot in a nonfiction context.
Yeah, that's a much easier question for me as a fiction writer. You know, the path to the universal is through the individual. And maybe it was Bernini, some Italian sculptor said, the art which is not a trifle is composed of trifles. And I think what he meant is, you know, you're just making thousands and thousands of little chisel strokes on a piece of marble. And eventually maybe you've made something transcendent, but 99% of your energy is in the work, in the hammering away. And, you know, that's how I feel about sentences. You know, you're working with these used and abused elements of everyday life, which are words, and you're trying to build something transcendent out of it. And what my students, what young writers, whatever age, but young in their careers, what they seem to miss is that they're striving for really big ideas often, you know, love or getting their heart broken. And often big ideas don't make for compelling narrative. And what does make for compelling narrative is very, very small, specific details. And that's, you know, why I love to leave home and to learn things about other places, because when you're there, you get to see what a bakery smells like. Or Lindsay took me past an incinerator last night on the way into town. There's a big incinerator, you know, and like that's a smell for Ames, Iowa, you know, that I won't forget. And that cold, you know, breath of all that steam going up into the night, that is a way to conjure a place. You know, often, especially undergraduate fiction will sometimes involve like, oh, I didn't want to set it anywhere because I wanted it to be every place, USA, every town, USA. But really, if you want to write about every town USA, invent the most specific and unique and idiosyncratic town you can. And eventually, the people there will say something about every town USA if they're real and specific enough. For me, you know, I came into reading because I wanted to be transported into other lives. Ultimately, I believe that empathy can be achieved through fiction, and that, you know, fiction is a moral thing. You read so that you are not alone, and you read to believe that human experiences can be shared. And so the more specific a story, really, the more engaging it is for me.
What is the difference between imagination or sort of the mindscape and the actual landscape, and how do the two sort of play off of each other?
I'll let you start
that question, man. You know, I don't know exactly the difference. I think that is what you're always struggling with. You know, what is objectivity? You know, if you're in Vilnius, Lithuania, and you've just fallen in love, it looks different than if you're 3,000 miles away from home and scared and, you know, you have a headache or something. Although somebody made a great there was a great joke at lunch today about how maybe you're in love and you have gastroenteritis, and those are the same thing. we talked about John Muir at lunch today, and that's a perfect example of somebody like, you can go, a book called Travels in Alaska, I think it's Travels in Alaska. You can see Alaska 1,000 times, but it's not quite like seeing it through the consciousness of John Muir and that ecstatic burst of prose and somebody in love with exclamation points and leaping from boulder to boulder. And, you know, some people get tired of it, but I don't. I'm just like, oh, ecstasy for 20,000, you know, pages of John Muir. That's great. I'll take it. And so you can't separate, of course. And I think it's maybe a fallacy to even suggest that you could write an objective story. It would feel dead. I mean, the eyes of the person through which you see a place, whether it's a fictional character or Rolf Potts, you know, that determines what you're seeing. And that's the joy. Like I said, reading is transportation, and that's what I want to be. I want to be transported into other worlds and other eyes and other minds.
Well, one reason I kicked that question to you is that you do an interesting job in Four Seasons of Rome of talking about difference, of talking about being new to a place and how newness makes a place feel alive. And like old habits, you can actually learn things about your home by suddenly listening to sirens in Rome, or, you know, trying to find the screen on a window that doesn't have screens.
Yeah, trying to flush a toilet or buy bread or buy diapers. Those things are more
exactly.
challenging if you're in another country.
Exactly. So those are details, I think, that you things that you brought out very effectively in that book. And those are encouraging words for someone who wants to go to a new place and write about those places, because I think sometimes fresh eyes are as legitimate as the eyes of locals or the eyes of habit. And there's people who live in New York or Ames or Rio who have stopped seeing their own city You know, so just because someone has invested half a lifetime in a place doesn't mean that they are an authority on it, because odds are they eat at the same restaurant every week and they have stopped seeing their own home with the eyes of a traveler. So one advantage of using travel as a way to see places, including your own home, is that it gives you those fresh eyes that I think are as important as deep research. And I think one shouldn't do it at the expense of deep research. I did another chapter in my book is about Australia, and I had a lot of very fresh insights of what was happening to me at each moment and what was new about that. But I knew that Australia is a place. I was traveling in Aboriginal parts of Australia, and I know that that's a very politically loaded thing to write about in Australia. And so I realized that despite the conclusions I had made and the things that I had seen in the fleeting time I was there, that I was going to have to go back in the writing and really learn a lot about the history and the politics of Aboriginal life in Australia, lest it end up being a well-observed but very naive essay. So I guess there's a balance, but just, you know, adding on to what I was observing about Tony's book about Rome is that fresh eyes count for a lot, and that even those simple differences can make a place come alive in writing.
It's true. I mean, if those of you who like the novel Lolita, I mean, those are fresh eyes on the English language in a sense, because he didn't grow up with all the patterns and habits and cliches of an English speaker. So that's what I mean by habitualization, you know, and I'm hard on my students who resort to cliches, because I feel like, you know, when you resort to a cliche, it's one small but significant failure to your work. You know, you're sleepwalking through a sentence. And, you know, I'm interested in writing because I don't want to sleepwalk through life. I feel like we have a very, very, very appallingly brief time on Earth, and we're here to see as much as we can and understand and do as much good as we can before we're gone. And, you know, when you go see Spider-Man 15, which I will do, I'm sure, you know, you know everything that's going to happen in that film. You know that structure, that pattern is a habit. You know that a white lead will kiss a white female lead, 4 seconds before the credits. And you can predict everything else that will happen in there. And sometimes it's fine. You're tired. You know, you had a long day. It's okay to expect the familiar and pay $9 for it, but there's also something to shaking up your life and, you know, challenging yourself to see things in new ways and force yourself out of the habits. Whether it's a simple decision as today I'm going to walk a different route to the Union, or, you know, today I'm going to bring my mother into my dorm room, you know, that changes the way you see familiar things very quickly. You know, those little decisions during the day can really make a difference. And that's what I mean by cliche. Using cliches in sentences is a small failure.
I was wondering, despite all the work that you do, the different countries that you write about, the different places that you write about, sort of what is the tension, or is there a tension in the idea of home when you write about other places or when you travel to other places? And how does home or the idea of home influence your craft?
You want to start it?
Sure. Home has changed quite a bit for me since I had kids 7 years ago. Home is a real thing for me, and it changes everything about travel, not just your writing. You know, you feel a little sick and sad if you're gone for very long, and you feel guilty, and home is a lot more important and fun place to be when you have children. In terms of work, you know, often the work I'm drawn to the most is work that involves some kind of spatial tension in fiction. Somebody is somewhere, but they long to be somewhere else. You know, you give a character in Milwaukee a lover in Jamaica, and suddenly there's spatial tension. There's a dialectic set up between, in that sense, also between tropical and Milwaukee. Which is about as different as you can get, but also, you know, that somebody, there's desire implicit, that somebody longs to be somewhere else. And that's what good fiction comes out of, I think, is desire, you know, longing, striving against your current situation.
I thought a couple different things came to mind. One was this 1977 New Yorker article about coherencia, which somebody just forwarded to me, and I'll probably misquote it exactly, but coherencia is sort of an affection for home. It's a Spanish word that sort of gives you a sense of place in the world, that by loving and knowing a specific place, then you have a context to appreciate other parts in the world. And I forget what they mentioned in that story. I'm thinking that they mentioned like Conrad's knowledge of London helped him understand the Congo. But then I think he's another second language writer. And so to me, I recently got a house in Kansas, and I think that has helped. Having an affection for a single place has helped me interpret other places and the people that live there, the people who relate to a place that I see as a foreign place. These people relate to it as home. And going back again to Mr. Ibrahim, you know, his love, he had an insane love for Beirut. And so that was part of his character, was tied up into who he was as home, at home. The second thing I thought of is how much home has changed, how living in Ames, Iowa 100 years ago gave you a different relationship with place than living in Ames, Iowa now, when you can have Facebook friends all over the place and, you know, you're tweeting certain experiences and you're watching a Spider-Man movie that's set in, you know, we're not Gotham City, that's Superman. But just our relationship with where we are and our relationship with place is less place-based. Is this another lunch conversation? That was a really productive lunch. The idea that you have more images in a day than you used to see in a lifetime. And that, actually, we were talking about the Jardin des Plantes in Paris, the botanical gardens, and how in the 18th century and the 19th century, you couldn't just fly to South America and Africa to see what the jungle looked like. And so a lot of French artists would go to the botanical gardens and see their exotic species and make paintings. A lot of writers would go if they wanted to describe the jungle based upon the botanical gardens in Paris. We don't have that problem now. We don't have that challenge now. And we might not. Another example, I remember being in Mongolia a few years ago, and my driver said, oh, look, there's a steppe fox. And where? There's a steppe fox. Well, it was like 2 miles away. We didn't see the steppe fox until it was 200 yards away. Well, he sees the landscape in a different way. You know, we see in an urban sense now, and we navigate life in a context that's full of people and things and images. Whereas someone who had lived a more pastoral life in Mongolia, he'd probably be overwhelmed in a city, but he can see a steppe fox when it's 2 miles away. So that was the second thought I had, that we are experiencing home in different ways in 2012 than we did in 1982 or 1882.
Yeah, it's so true that technology in some ways can get in the way of really experiencing a place, especially if you're missing somebody back home and you're on your phone a lot. You can go through a day in Florence and still half of your whole soul is in Iowa, you know, and that is a blessing and a curse all at once. It makes me think, what you were just saying makes me think of this really interesting writer named Wade Davis, who writes really well about Polynesian navigators and how, you know, in American schools, we're just drilled that progress is this curve that sweeps ever upward and that our lives are so much better than our grandparents. And man, our grandparents' lives were so much better than their great-grandparents. And isn't our toilet paper so soft? And isn't it so great to have avocados in January? And those things are a miracle. But, you know, I remember when we lived in Rome for a year and, you know, walking through the Forum, you would overhear tour guides say, you know, notice how the masonry gets better the deeper we go. That, like, literally, we've lost a lot of skills in the Pantheon, in the roof of the Pantheon, which is the longest still standing structure with a roof in the world. There's cement 2,100 years old in that roof that we still don't understand exactly how it was mixed. You know, like the men and women maybe mixing that cement, you know, we had skills that we've totally lost. Wade Davis writes about these navigators who would be able to tell, they grow up basically in canoes. They're at sea much more than they're on land. And they would be able to tell if there are islands coming, even though you couldn't see them with the naked eye, just by the patterns of waves around them, that they could tell how far away they were from land. And that's how they managed these unbelievable crossings, you know, 4,000 miles of ocean in an open boat. So, you know, I do get nostalgic for that sometimes. You know, my sons, I try to teach them about the weeds around the house, but often I run up against the limits of my own ignorance. You know, I'm like, I think this is an invasive species, but maybe we shouldn't pull it. I don't know. And they're like, can we go play Super Mario Brothers, Dad?
Jared Diamond talked about that in the context of mushrooms in Papua New Guinea, you know, that people who lived there knew more than a scientist would ever know about mushrooms because they'd grown up knowing exactly which ones to eat and which ones not to eat. And just since you mentioned toilet paper, even the idea that soft toilet paper is the best way to clean yourself is a culturally relative statement. I mean, you go to India and people use water. And if you say to them, why do you use water? That's gross. They'll say, if you had dung on your face, would you wipe it off with paper or would you wash it off with water? And it's like, oh, okay. So, you know, those are the very basic relationships that travel can completely transform your relationship with Charmin, you know. So I guess it's just another example of how your home, you can see your home through a different lens.
You know? So true. Yeah. And then when I was 19, I spent 7 months in Kenya and Tanzania. And I remember coming back and all I really had to drink there was tea, beer, or Fanta. They had like very delicious Fanta there. And I came home and I remember going into the convenience store and just seeing the drinks. It was like before even Monster Energy drinks and Red Bull took over the convenience store. And I'm just like, we have so many drinks in America. You know, something you would never, ever realize. Like, why do we need 17 flavors of Gatorade?
Thank you. Just one last question before we go to the audience. Speaking in the area of craft and maybe also a little bit about ethics, which is something that we've touched on, what are some common mistakes you find when writers attempt to write about cultural experiences outside of their realm, whether it be it through nonfiction or through fiction? What are some ethical problems in that or some complications that come up? And how do you remain truly faithful to a place that you're writing about?
Well, that's a question that's dogged travel writing since there's been travel writing, simply because it's harder to fact check a story when you can't fly to some place or you don't have an internet connection. And travel writing has had a bad, and I'm talking about nonfiction travel writing, has had a bad reputation since the beginning because there's no way to verify that the tribe of Africans who had a giant lip that covered their head in the sunshine existed, or the race of men who hopped around on one leg. Or the giant, delicious bean that was as big as your forearm and tasted like honey. Well, that third one is something Marco Polo talked about, and people made fun of him for it when he came back. But he was just describing a banana, right? So travel writing has always sort of existed in the haze of distance. And it's only recently that – it's another thing I write about in my book. It's only recently that you can write about somebody in Ethiopia or Cambodia or Paraguay, and then they can read what you wrote and say – and call BS on you, right? So I think to a bigger extent, a lot of these cross-cultural issues are being sort of policed in a 2.0 sense. You know, collectively we're sort of policing each other's cultural perception of each other. But how to approach it ethically, I guess just beware of expectations and stereotypes, learn how to listen, know your limitations. I have severe linguistic interpretations, so I know if I am communicating with a lot of people in Cambodia, for instance, it's probably going to be Cambodians who can speak English because I can't speak Cambodian, and that's going to affect the nature of who I'm talking with and who I get my information from. And I think just sort of acknowledging complexity and portraying complexity is important for the same reasons I said before, is that you're not going to get it through the news and you're not going to get it through tourism advertising. And, you know, talking about the common humanity, you know, addressing the common humanity of other places without being too hippy-dippy and generalist and completely bland about it, because even though we do have a lot in common as humans, we obviously have huge cultural differences that have to be understood and parsed and confronted and bumped up against. And so I feel like that's something. I guess I don't have a pat answer. I guess it comes in the effort of being true to the places you're trying to experience.
Yeah, in terms of fiction writing, you know, it's all a matter of degrees. You know, I mean, you have to claim a lot of cultural knowledge just to write a story set in your neighbor's house. You know, I mean, there's a lot about that family's culture that you don't know. I just tell my students to not let the write what you know advice. Have you guys all heard that advice before? Write what you know. Not to let that kill their imaginative ambition. If you're interested in writing about violent making or a Finnish washerwoman in 1750, you're going to have to do a lot of work if you're not a violent maker or you didn't live in 1750, but that doesn't mean you can't do it. I mean, I think the effort of making your work plausible is your responsibility. And if you can convince readers that this universe is real and you've only alienated, say, 1 in 10,000 readers, then because you've got a mollusk in the wrong ocean, for example, not that I've ever done that. But, you know, occasionally, if you slip on a detail, that's, you know, that's your small failure of responsibility. But as long as you're a responsible researcher, I think you should try. As a fiction writer, the great joy is that everything you're curious in about can eventually be useful to you. So, yeah, one example, I think I'm going to read a story tonight called The Deep, which is set in the 1920s. Yeah, The Deep. Interesting. And one of the characters in there speaks often, uses very ridiculous similes. And at a garage sale, I came across this book. I think it was maybe 1919, very tiny pamphlet. And it's like, overused similes or something like that. And it was a gold mine for me, you know. It was like 5 cents and the paper's all yellow and falling apart. But I wish I could give you some examples, some really racist examples in there, and, you know, misogynist ones. But, you know, it's all these ones, that these cliches that have now become new again. So, you know, I use those and put them in the mouth of a character. I guess that's one example. There are a lot of different things you can do besides just library research, I guess is what I'm saying. I use a Sears catalog. Right now I'm writing a book set during World War II, and I use Sears catalogs a lot and looking through them just to see, like, what might be on a dresser in 1940 or what might be in an ice chest. You know, those things are very, it's a magical thing that you can bring those, with a few keystrokes, you can bring up those images right in front of your eyes. In Boise, Idaho, where I live, you know.
I love the idea of using popular culture instead of academic culture to make a place or a time period come alive. I think that's true. I've heard a historian say once that if you want to write about the 1930s and you're wondering if you understand the 1930s, open up a New Yorker and see if the cartoons are funny. And if the cartoons aren't funny, then you probably don't understand the 1930s enough to get those jokes, and you probably need to research a little bit more about that place. I have a friend, actually Gina Oshner. She graduated from Iowa State. I think she got an MA from Iowa State. She writes a lot of stories set in Eastern Europe and Russia, which she has. You know, she's never lived there as an expatriate. She's visited them quite a bit, and we were talking about ways. She and I were talking about ways to get into the place, and I challenged her to learn a joke in every place that she went. And I think that there's something, if you can learn a joke, because so many jokes are tied to language or culture or social expectations, that jokes can be an interesting window into place. And so I think, yeah, I think there's a lot of counterintuitive ways to get to know a place in a deep way. And one great way is to stay there for a while.
Yeah, I was on book tour in Germany once, and escort, she was like, oh, there's one added event we were going to take you to tonight. So we left Berlin in like this tiny car, like an hour. I'm like, where are we going? It's really dark through these woods. And we come to this gymnasium, and inside are a bunch of teachers, all women, around tables in a full circle, and there's a podium. And she's like, okay, now you can read from your book. I'm like, okay, that sounds terrible. You go up to the microphone, and they're still eating, their backs to me. There's no introduction. I'm like, hello. And I read for a little while, like this very, I don't know why I chose this passage about insects in the winter in Alaska. And afterward, they get in line. I'm like, wow, they're all going to buy copies of my book. And they were teachers who were looking for accreditation, like they had to go to something in English. And so I had to sign like 45 forms for these teachers to show that they came to my event. And then you drive an hour back in this tiny car, and I sat in my hotel in Berlin. I'm like, you know, this is why I left my home to do this. You know?
I have an equivalent story of that, actually. Of signing books in the shopping mall of my adopted hometown in Kansas, and how I'd done these very well-attended events in New York and Seattle. And there I am sitting in the mall with a bunch of people who just don't care at all about my travel book. And then I sort of tried to engage people, and I felt like a guy dressed as a chipmunk handing out flyers to a donut shop on a big street. You know, it was that very deep humiliation that comes with that. Actually, I wasn't just farting around with my cell phone. I actually, in a very postmodern nod to Tony, I actually tweeted one of his quotes the other day. And I tweeted, it says, "The easier an experience, the fainter our sensation of it becomes. Complexities wane, miracles become unremarkable." So I think the humiliation that comes with travel is a way of embracing, you know, being. You know, it's a way of getting past the superficial comfort level of life and getting closer to the edge of experience. And I've had a lot of, yeah. I think unless you're being regularly humiliated, you're not traveling hard enough, you know.
Yeah, it's a really nice question, Deborah. It's so true. In the book that Rolf briefly mentioned that I wrote called Four Seasons in Rome, I finally, after about 6 months, I felt like I was getting Italian a little bit. We would always go to the grocer where you have to ask for everything. Everything's either behind glass in terms of the meat or it's up on a shelf behind the grocer. So you have to learn the vocabulary for all this stuff. And I remember we wanted to make spaghetti and I just needed a can of tomatoes and I kept asking for pompelmo. I wanted sugo di pompelmo, which is grapefruit sauce. And I'm like, and sugo di pomodoro is tomato sauce. I'm like, I want that sugo di pompelmo. And the guy's like, what the hell? We don't have that. I'm like, what is this problem? I'm fluent. I'm totally fluent in Italian. What is your problem? I want my grapefruit sauce.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about the novels of Anthony Doerr and Iowa State University's annual Symposium on Wildness, Wilderness, and the Creative Imagination, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.